shut down. You gotta keep going. You gotta think about your phone.
It's alright, Chappie. It's gonna be fine. I'm going to make it.
Just remember to play that tape I gave you. You know, that tape.
Which one, Chappie? The one with Megadeth or the one with, is it Iron Maiden?
No, no, the other tape. The other tape. Look out, dog. Here they come.
Chappie! I'm the leader, boy. Howdy doody out there, listeners. How you going? Adam Oberon here, the Lethal Mullet from Quinlan's Cantina, the Gold Coast of Australia. For, of course, Lethal Mullet podcast on the Lethal Mullet Network. Great, I got that out. Now we can chat some movies. That's right, we're going to be chatting Iron Eagle tonight. First in a series of Iron Eagle-themed podcasts as we chat about not only the first film, we're going to be looking at the second, third, and one I haven't seen yet. One that Kyle Wagner of the Phantom Podcast Network has told me I need to see because Doug Masters is back in the final one. Obviously, he was in the second, but apparently got bumped off, we assume killed, as was in the movie. But if we find out that he was held prisoner by the evil forces and then left for dead and never picked up by Chappie, but this time he goes, Chappie! And they go and find him. And that's the movie I've got to see yet, so it's number four. But I've got to say, folks, I've enjoyed each of these films for what they are. The second one's a bit more of a Police Academy-style one. It's a bit of a comedy. But the third one is absolutely fantastic. And you get Toshiro Mifune in that one as well. It's called Aces. That's right, Aces Iron Eagle 3. So again, we're going to be looking at those. They are definitely Lethal Mullet territory all here on this network. But here's where you can find the show and many others like it. G'day, mate. How you going? Welcome to the Lethal Mullet Network, where you'll find all these amazing shows and more. Where you'll find the Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of action cinema from the 80s, 90s, and beyond. You'll also find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Mark Newbold, into a deep dive of Star Trek. You can also find Mullet and Kilt, a look at music, where I'm joined by my dear pal, Darth Elvis, and where you can also find the Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe. All here on, of course, lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on your favourite podcatcher. You can find us there. You can also find all these shows a week later on, of course, the one, the only Phantom Podcast Network, FPN, on fpnet.podbean.com. Don't forget to also follow us on socials. There's, of course, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at the handle at the Lethal Mullet. We'll catch you out there and enjoy your action cinema.
Hi, can I help you, sir?
Yes. I'd like you to patch me in with Mr. Kyle Wagner.
Mr. Kyle Wagner, did you say? Just give me a second. I'll see what I can do. I'm here in Sacramento, so I've got to try and... one second.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Cheers, thanks for your effort.
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Well, it seems that we are waiting on Kyle, so we'll get into the news, folks, while he's racing his way to the studio. And now, it's time for the news here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. All right, we're just going to patch in via the... Oh, looks like he's hot on the heels of the freeway on the way. Kyle, are you there? We're just going to try him on the phone lines. One sec. Here we go. Hey, Kyle.
Kyle. Hey, buddy. Are you there, mate?
All right, folks, seems to be that he's still on the way in that massive, huge V8 muscle car of his, so we'll just wait till he gets here.
Ah!
All right, guys, welcome to the news. And the news is also here and now because we have a man that's just stepped out of his humongous Chevy motor engine car, a massive muscle car that's been screaming all the way from Florida to, of course, the Lethal Mullet Studios right here. The one, the only, the man behind the wheel, the man with the plan, and the man with the best editing suite you've ever seen. The man is Carl Wagner. Pal, how are you?
I am doing well, but gas prices are killing me, man.
I bet you were burning some rubber, too. I'm surprised you got any rubber left on them tires.
Oh, no, that's why I'm in the pits. They're changing them out as we speak, so.
Now, what I should say, folks, what really happened was we were just waiting on the Waypodge fellas to finish their weekly show. So big shout out to, of course, Derek Scott and Mr. Miracle over there, and I hope they've enjoyed putting together their show. I'm sure they're looking at the back end of the Bad Batch series over there.
Yeah, don't make the Gooey Chewy mad, because he will take your arms and rip them out of their sockets. I've seen him do it.
I've got to say, the three boys have got so much passion when it comes to Star Wars, and I think the interesting thing is having Scott on recent episode, obviously, of Lethal, chatting Buck Rogers, their passion comes from different ages as well. They're all different age groups, which is a great thing to see where they've come into Star Wars.
Yeah, I know I will be making an appearance on What a Piece of Junk later in September when Star Wars Visions comes out, because I will be bringing the anime knowledge to What a Piece of Junk.
It's about bloody time that Lucasfilm have been doing so many influenced by animated shows, and obviously influenced by other things as well, but anime's been something that Star Wars never really tapped into except for the manga books.
They did the manga books, but they didn't really market that. Probably the most famous Star Wars anime thing is actually an unlicensed thing that is on the YouTubes, where a guy did a homemade, fan-made anime using a TIE Fighter Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really made the round on YouTube. It's really, really sharp, really polished, really well-looking. And I'm honestly surprised it's taking Star Wars so long to get down this rabbit hole.
And Marvel's done it before with the four selected animes that they put out a little while ago, which had X-Men, Wolverine, it had Blade, and it had
Iron Man.
Iron Man was, probably the best out of the lot there, I thought. But the Blade one was pretty good, too.
The Blade one was pretty good. The Wolverine one was a little rough, and the X-Men one had its moments.
Yeah, I fell asleep in the X-Men one. I usually, anime keeps me going usually. It just, I don't know, it didn't quite clink. But the thing is, those four actually came together quite well in the fact that you had to watch one to understand the other. They crossed over.
Yeah, no, it's interesting when you speak of anime too, because here in the United States, thanks to Funimation, and who just spent $5.7 billion to buy Crunchyroll, which is another major anime streaming service. But Funimation has also announced on their released on their streaming service, and will be putting out in physical Blu-ray here soon. But they have released their high definition remasters of Robotech on their streaming service.
This is true, folks. It comes out literally next week, so it's only around the corner now. Where we're going to have this release now. This is the first of a few interesting releases. Next week, we get the 4K release of David Lynch's 1984 Dune as well, which is coming out in a nice box set. This will have to be about the 7th or 8th version of the 84 release that I'm picking up.
Yeah, it's up there in release time. I don't think maybe we're even looking at close to double digits.
It could be. I mean, there's that many different versions over the years of this film. Now, not only has there been a DVD edition that came out, I don't know when it was, early 2000s. There was also one that came out in around about, I think it was about 2005, 2006, just after the miniseries ones. And that was a new release with all the different versions. It had the Alan Smithy cut. It also had the featurettes you could get on there with Raffaella Di Laurentiis basically saying, yeah, we kind of made a bit of a mess, but it's a beautiful mess. And then went on to talk about all the other stuff involved in it. But it'd be still amazing to see this in 4K.
Yeah, it should be. I'll be curious to see how some of those effects hold up in 4K.
Mm-hmm. Well, folks, we've also got that. We've got, obviously, a lot of other Dune stuff coming. So stay tuned to this channel for, of course, The Moloch Guild, which will be exclusive to this channel very soon, along with, of course, Making Treks, which comes back next week. Making Treks next week is going to be really interesting. Mark wanted to really look at some of the newer Trek that's come out and how it referenced the old shows. Of course, we talked a little bit about Lower Decks, and we also talked about how Riker has sort of jumped around quite a bit, not only in these shows, but others, where we get to see the happy Riker, we get to see the Red Alert Riker, and we also get to see basically a little bit more of a comedic Riker that we used to see in TNG in Lower Decks.
This is true. Riker seems to be making the popular rounds through all the Star Trek shows that are currently running. Of course, I'm excited personally for Strange New Worlds because I loved Ansem Elgort as Pike, and I loved everything to do with that cast and the fact that they're giving them their own show. I cannot wait for that. I know that's later on in 2021 after Lower Decks finishes up. I think Lower Decks is highly underrated. I think Lower Decks has been a ton of surprisingly good fun, and I think the show has a really nice balance to it of taking itself serious enough and making not afraid to have those jokes without going too over the top like Rick and Morty has a tendency to do, since we're talking about the same creators.
I'm going to say I've never gotten into Rick or Morty, so am I related to the joke of Rick and Morty or what?
Basically, I mean, they were think of it as a really, really weird Doc Brown, Marty McFly kind of thing. It's a very popular show, and there's some really good episodes, but there's some episodes that they take it too far.
Mm. So it sounds like it's got that whole, what could we say? It's a juvenile sort of a show, is it?
Yeah, oh yeah, it definitely has some juvenile humor in it, for sure.
There we are, folks. So maybe I need to check this out, particularly if it's got movie references, etc. Now, I've got to say too, folks, we've got a great show for you coming after this. It's already recorded, which will be 117, Lethal Mullet, and that is Split Second, looking at Rutger Hauer and, of course, his fight with the aliens. They're aliens in there. And, of course, that was with Dan Hadley of Spacebook on Facebook and, of course, Type 40, a Top Who podcast. We spend the first half of the show chatting about BBC shows, which you've never heard of if you're in the States. And, of course, the old days of Tom Baker, because he is Doctor Who. All these other imitators, they're not Doctor Who, because it's Tom Baker. Tom Baker is Doctor Who.
I have a question for you on that podcast. Was there enough oxygen in the room for you and Dan? I love you guys, but you both have the gift of gab.
We do. You know, I got to say, it was hard for both of us getting words in because we come up with something and you want to chip in on the top, go, but hang on. But. There's a lot of but. Great show. But I've got to say, too, great to go through some of the goodies, monkey, and all that other stuff, which Dan has decided to come back on the show in a couple of weeks' time, and we are going to look at some of these shows. We are going to educate you all on what these shows are from the BBC. So you'll all find out, and then it'll have that little thing with the little council top in the background and the Thames, and it'll say a Thames production. That's what we're talking about.
What you don't know is living in Alaska like I did for such a long time, we would get the oddball stuff, which means we got some of those oddball BBC shows. And so the only thing I'm going to say to that is I'm afraid. I am very afraid.
You're very afraid. I heard you're a bit of a Michael Crawford fan.
A little bit, but, you know.
Have you ever heard of a show called Some Mothers Do Have 'Em?
It rings a bell, but I can't place it. But I do want to say, too, you guys were talking about doing a Rutger Hauer film. Well, I'm curious, what is your, outside of the obvious, what is your favorite Rutger Hauer film?
It's a cross between two films, and it's Wedlock or Blind Fury.
See, I'm a big Blind Fury guy, but I also like him in Wanted Dead or Alive.
It's a great film, too. See, Kevin was the one that really got me into watching that, and I love it. It's a great film, but it doesn't have quite the comedic beats that... both Wedlock, which is a very commercial film for the time, and, of course, Blind Fury. Of course, we've covered that here on the channel, folks. If you want to go to look at the back catalogue, you'll find a Blind Fury Zatoichi episode where we go through Zatoichi and Blind Fury because it's the same movie, folks, really. It's a retelling. And would you like some chili with your sauce? What's that, with your hot dog? That's right, from that film, the same thing, all the lines at the start. It's cheesy, but it is there. And, of course, I'm getting the shake of the head already. I remember all that cheese from that one. And, of course, get Randall Tex Cobb, one of the greatest boxers in kickboxers from the 1980s. A lot of people don't remember how good he was on talk shows back then, too. All you got to do is look up Randall Tex Cobb Late Night Show. Look it up. It's hilarious because he speaks his mind and he can speak for you. There you go. Go and check it out.
You did not want to get into a fight with Randall Tex Cobb. He was a legitimate tough man.
He's the real deal. A lot of people would just joke and think that what they saw in the movies that he did, like Uncommon Valor and all that other stuff, was all baloney.
Don't remember his turn. He had a run in The Golden Child with Eddie Murphy.
He did too, and he was also in Raising Arizona with the double shotguns on the back of the Harley and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great one. Actually, that's a lethal one, folks. We will do Raising Arizona here one day soon. Crazy film, one of the craziest Nick Cage films out there, almost as bad as Bangkok Dangerous.
No, I don't know. There's a lot of crazy films on the Nick Cage.
Hi. Mate, how you going? Come on in, mate. Yeah, yeah. What shall it be?
Oh, yeah. Man, it's been real busy, D, you know? Oh, wow.
Right,
yeah.
Mate.
Hey. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like I was telling my mate the other day, you know, have a nice, cold beverage. But tonight, folks, we're going to be chatting about a Lewis Gossett Jr. franchise.
Enjoy this beverage and enjoy this.
And, of course, one that had a hell of a cast, which has been in and out of the movies constantly. We're, of course, talking about Iron Eagle. And Iron Eagle is an interesting one for us to look at tonight because it's not just one movie. It is four movies. There wasn't a fifth, as far as I'm aware, but there's definitely four. Out of those four,
I think there's a lot of people who wish it would have stopped after one.
I know. I like Aces. Aces is a nice little movie. I like it. They obviously just bought an air show and basically said, right, let's do a plot around an air show.
But no, the original Iron Eagle is, to me, still an 80s cult classic. And I know we'll talk about it a little more, but one of those movies that was probably it was a solid movie, but got lost in the tidal wave of a major Hollywood movie with a similar style, shall we say.
Pretty much exactly the same year as well. I mean, it was one that came out in that mid-80s point when Tom Cruise was just getting huge. You can imagine the movie we're about to talk about, and it's got its own sequel on the way. Only, what is it, 35-plus years later, or whatever it is. But Iron Eagle is a 1986 military action film directed by Sidney J. Fury. It was written by Kevin Allen Elders and co-written by Sidney as well, starring, of course, Jason Gedrick and Lewis Gossett Jr. Now, this is a film which has often been, I think, in the same ballpark as Karate Kid and other films where it's a teenager coming to terms with being a man or, you know, in the case of being an adult and having to basically rely on their own training, their own fears to be passed so that they can get to the end of the film. So their own climax. It's a hero's journey with jets, in this case, F-16s. And, of course, this is very much in the lines of the movie that Kyle just mentioned, of course, Top Gun. The film earned over $24 million at the box office, and it was followed by Iron Eagle 2, Aces Iron Eagle 3, and Iron Eagle on the Attack number 4. Gossett's the only one. It was in all the films. Interesting.
Yeah. Here's the thing about the original Iron Eagle. I'm a fan of it. I'm not even going to lie. I'm a huge fan of the original Iron Eagle. But the premise of it is so out there.
When you really stop
and think about it, the premise is just absolutely insane. But it's one of those kind of movies in the 80s you just kind of accepted and rolled with it and you had fun with it. And Iron Eagle is that. It's a movie you have fun with. And it also helps that it has one absolutely amazing 80s soundtrack to go with it. But yeah, Iron Eagle falls into those categories of one of the more interesting 80s films because of things that happened with it.
Oh, without a doubt. And the fact that, you know, it really should have been a Jason Gedrick franchise as well as a Lewis Gossett Jr. one.
Oh, it definitely should have been a Jason Gedrick franchise. And, you know, Jason Gedrick for a while was looking to be kind of another heartthrob in U.S. movies, and it just didn't quite pan out the way they planned it. I remember he kind of, he did Iron Eagle, had a lot of recognition from there, did a few other things, but really never took off like he did. Then he made an appearance on the American TV show Ally McBeal and got real popular again, but then he had some stuff happen, and it just, it never seemed to go quite right and make that step for Jason Gedrick that a lot of people thought it was. And again, I come to the fact that this film, I think, would have been a bigger success had it not gotten caught up in the tidal wave that was, at the time, Top Gun.
Yeah, it's a big part of that being, obviously, Top Gun had a huge actor play in making this pretty much a video hit, not a theatrical hit. It came out here on VHS, never saw a theatrical release here in Brisbane or Gold Coast.
See, but you have to understand, Top Gun in the States was an absolutely huge theatrical movie. It was in theaters for almost an entire year.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. Australia was on the drive-ins constantly for about 2 years, so it was huge. So it pretty much washed out anything else that was airport or Air Force related. Interesting that way. The starring, obviously, we've mentioned the first two stars. We've also got Larry B. Scott in it, Carolyn Lagerfeld, and, of course, the British actor, David Suchet. Of course, you might know him from Executive Decision, and I think it's Poirot's Mysteries, the old, again, BBC. and, of course, hey, look, it's your favourite, Kyle. Look, it's Tim Thomason. It's Future Cop.
Yeah, I believe he played the father in this film, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, Tim Thomason. Better known as Jack Death. Jack Death is going to hunt down the Trancers. Again, one of those actors that's in just about everything. He's even in the scene in, of course, Air America with, of course, Mel Gibson and Robert De Niro. No, not Robert De Niro. Who is it? It was Robert...
Danny Jr. You know it.
Danny Jr., that's right. And where Danny Jr. says, oh my God, excuse me, is that a newsie?
Exactly.
And he breaks it out.
No, yeah, crazy. Exactly. So, you know, one of the things with Iron Eagle that I find so interesting is if it were to come out 10 years later, it would probably have been a straight direct to DVD kind of film. Because when you look at it and you compare it to Top Gun with the effects of the flying and how it went, at the time it felt like if it would come out before Top Gun, you would have kind of rolled with it and went, yeah, okay, this is pretty good. It kind of has a little bit of that Red Dawn kind of feel to it or things like that. But the problem was, is Top Gun, with how they filmed the flight scenes and using the F-14 Tomcats and actually being able to have the access that they had, this movie just didn't stand a chance as far as that goes. But this movie is still just so much fun.
It is. Look, I mean, the flying sequences, for us back in the days of VHS, it still looked good. But if you watch it now on Blu-ray or DVD, it doesn't hold up at all. You know that it's just military footage that's been given to the film company to use by the Air Force. And the scenes of the cockpit and stuff like that, they're zoomed right in. You can tell they're not going anywhere, you know. There was even a Stargate film on TV that was done better than the filming they did of this, where they're sitting in the cockpits, but they were smart enough to move the things on a dolly through the actual airport so that they would get different cloud formations and stuff like that to look like they're flying.
Well, they
didn't bother with this.
Well, what's amazing is actually the best flying sequences in this film are at the beginning when they have the canyon race where you have the character of Doug Masters racing against the character of Notcher who's on a motorcycle, but there's some great Cessna plane flying in this, but there's also some very horrible green screen shots with the other actors as well.
Oh, yeah. And that's right. The guy on the motorcycle, folks, is from Kill Bill, and his name is Buck, and he likes to, well, leave it to your imagination. And obviously, he's also in, what was it? It was Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
It was one of the cops in Jackie Brown as well. Mm-hmm. Now, this film was shot by Adam Greenberg, cinematographer. It's put out by Delphi Films and, of course, the old TriStar, which was huge back in the days of the 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. It was released
This is the height of TriStar.
It really is. Yeah. Mountain of TriStar back then. It came out January 17, 1986. Budget of $18 million and made $24. So you can see why they were actually highly anticipating to make a sequel, weren't they?
Yeah, no, and if, again, I come back to it. I think if this is 10 years later, Iron Eagle's a direct-to-DVD film.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's particularly when they waited for so long to get everything going. The story is based on real-life attacks that the U.S. did against Libya. And it was called the Gulf of Sidra moment back in 1981. This is not one I'm aware of. Do you know of any of these sorts of events back in
the 80s? No, I was not aware of that. It was actually picked off from some real-life attacks.
Interesting. So, yeah, the Gulf of Sidra, I'll bring this up while we're chatting about it, folks. But this is not one we're aware of out here in Australia. But it looks like it was between the US and Libya back in 81, where a Libyan Su-22 was fired upon and was subsequently shot down by two US F-14s off the coast of Libya.
Interesting. Yeah, I was only about six at the time, so the news was not exactly something I was watching.
I think the same. Be too busy watching Doctor Who. Who?
There you go.
There you go. All right, so let's look at the cast. Louis Gossett Jr., great actor, fantastic guy, very comedic in this, plays Colonel Charles Chappie Sinclair. We hear the word Chappie a lot in this.
Oh, yeah. Well, Louis Gossett Jr. carries this movie. He was huge at the time. He was coming off Officer and a Gentleman and a few other things, and Enemy Mine, and... But he was absolutely huge in this. He was the star of this movie as far as the marketing goes, and he was a reason a lot of people went and saw this movie in the theaters because of him. And he is phenomenal as the character of Chappie St. Clair, kind of a second father figure to the Doug Masters character. And you could tell he was having fun while making this film. And just, you know, like I said, he is the heart of this film, without a doubt.
He's huge. Jason Gedrick as Doug Masters. Thoughts?
Again, with Gedrick, it was more of he should have hit so much bigger and he didn't. And it's one of those questions of I think most everybody's going to have is like, where did the wrong turn go? And some of it might even be when you think about it, he does Iron Eagle and then his character gets killed off in the first 10 minutes of Iron Eagle 2 or something. And then it just never seemed to catch for him. He was a good looking young guy. I just think he got kind of lost behind Tom Cruise and maybe a little bit of the Brat Pack and some of the guys there, especially like a Rob Lowe or something like that. He just never seemed to get that project to really launch him after Iron Eagle. And it's a bit of a shame. Yeah, like I said earlier, he had a bit of a career renaissance here in the States thanks to the show Ally McBeal, but it didn't last that long.
Interesting. David Suchet as Ministry of Defense Colonel Akir Nakesh. Now, he's an actor that's just done a hell of a lot of stuff. He is a CBE, English actor. He's played Edward Teller in Oppenheimer back in 1980. And, of course, yeah, here you go. He plays Hercule Poirot in Agatha Christie's Poirot from 1989 to 2013. And he's got many BAFTAs. BAFTAs. There you go.
Yeah. I am looking back at Jason Gedrick because I was kind of curious about, and yeah, he just never got that one role that really helped him get caught back up. There's some other people in this cast who I really want to stand out, and I think the two that really come to mind to me are the two actors who played the best friends of Doug Masters. Of course, you had Larry B. Scott, most famous probably for his roles in Revenge of the Nerds.
Ooh, Larry B. Scott, yes. Now, Larry B. Scott, somebody that's turned up in a lot of stuff, not just Revenge of the Nerds. I mean, he's in The Karate Kid, obviously. He was also in Extreme Prejudice as well.
Yeah, he also did the movie, another great 80s movie in Space Camp.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember Space Camp. Yeah. That's a good one.
But again, always been a bit more of an in-the-background character actor. He never really had that one movie that really took him off.
That's right. We also got Sean E. Smith in this, too.
Yes, you do. Yes, we do. We have Shawnee Smith in this.
Great in Becca. Oh. She was also great in The Stand. She was a standout in The Stand.
Yeah, she was. This was really before Shawnee Smith got really big. Shawnee Smith really got big on the TV show Becker with Ted Danson. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She is absolutely beautiful. Of course, too, you also have Jerry Levine in this. And Jerry Levine was definitely a bit of a character actor throughout his career and still is. He's actually had a pretty good run on the newest version of Hawaii 5-0. But you're probably going to remember him more for anything. He was also in the movie Teen Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And just again, another, he's one of those that what I call a that guy actor where you see him and you just know his face.
That's right. We've also got Lance LeGault in this as General Edwards, and he used to play a very similar role in The A-Team.
Yeah, this is true. But yeah, it's an interesting cast, but nobody who was ever, I mean, Lou Gossett Jr. is definitely the superstar if you're going to pick a superstar out of this film.
Without a doubt. Obviously, as we mentioned, Michael Bowen from Walking Tall, Jackie Brown, and of course, Kill Bill, where he plays Buck. So that's basically what you're looking at as the cast. But let's talk a little bit about the plot. So Doug Masters is the son of a U.S. Air Force colonel, the name of Ted Masters, and played by Tim. Ted played by Tim, there you go. Of course, Tim Thomason. And he's shot down. The story of this film is about the Air Force not wanting to politically get involved in trying to get the Colonel Masters out of the territory. Instead, it's up to his son to basically come up with a plan, along with Chappie, his new friend of the Air Force, and who is a retired but now reserve Air Force colonel, to try and get him and himself into the enemy area, get his father out, and get back safe. And this is a very interesting sort of, it's not only a political and military sort of intrigue film, it's also one coming-of-age sort of spy thriller.
Yeah, a bit of so. I want to go back to the actors in this film, though, because we did leave one person off the list, and that is the great Robbie Rist, of course, cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch.
Great actor.
Had done a lot of things, especially a lot of voice acting work over the latter part of his career, but probably outside of Lou Gossett Jr. might have been actually the most known of everybody in this film at the time this came out. But yeah, getting back to the main plot thread, I mean it's what makes this movie so much fun, especially when you go back and watch it now, is to see especially the relationship between Doug Masters and Chappie. Oh, yeah. But also the over-the-topness of what these kids were basically able to do, having their run of a military base, which we know there's just no way they get the information they got. But it's so much fun in how they do it. You kind of get lost with the absurdity of it. And the fact that you basically have this retired fighter pilot and these teenage kids getting all the information to run a rescue mission of this extent. The concept's ridiculous, but it works. And I think that's a typical staple of these kind of 80s movies. The concepts are just absolutely ridiculous, but there's something about them that makes them work, whether it's just how they write it, the enjoyableness of it. And again, I think in this film's case too, you have Lou Gossett Jr. who's just chewing up scenery left and right. And you have an amazing soundtrack where they use the soundtrack so effectively in this movie.
Yeah, they do. Look, the one thing is clear in this film, just like Top Gun to some extent, the rock soundtrack that they've got in this is played and tied right into Doug Masters' life. You know, the only time he flies well is when he's got his Walkman on, pretty much. And these are all classics when it comes to what's being played. Some great lead breaks and rock riffs and stuff like that. And some songs that a lot of you are going to know very, very well. What's the standout for you?
Oh, there's so many on this soundtrack. The soundtrack is absolutely amazing. Obvious, there's a lot of songs that were in this movie that weren't on the official soundtrack. But I mean, ones that come off that I remember, you have Road of the Gypsy by Adrenaline, which is a great song. Obviously, We're Not Going to Take It Anymore by Twisted Sister is used in this. You've got Eyes of the World by Eric Martin, which is probably my favorite song from the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. It's used when he's using the training montage. Obviously, this is also a very Queen-heavy soundtrack. You had a few songs by Queen, including the song, probably the most famous song on the soundtrack, was using Queen's One Vision on the soundtrack. That's they actually use it a couple of times. They use it when Doug is in the training simulator, and then again later when Chappie's they're running behind, and Doug plays some music, and Chappie's all over him for play the right kind of music, and then he puts on the Queen. He's like, oh, well, I can get used to this.
That's right. And what's great about it, his music comes in there too, with James Brown and the Famous Flames. There Was a Time with Proud Mary by Ike and Tina Turner. We've also got, obviously, Hide in the Rainbow by Dio. We've got Maniac House by Katrina and the Waves. Intense by George Clinton, one of the greats. There we are. And as you mentioned earlier, we've also got One Vision. These Are the Good Times by Eric Martin. And
yeah, he did King a couple Cobra's songs for the soundtrack.
That's right. And King Cobra's Never Say Die.
Yep, Never Say Die. I'm an eagle. Okay, I apologize to our listeners for that one, but the thing that works about this, and I haven't really seen another movie incorporate the soundtrack like this until much later on, to me, when Guardians of the Galaxy came out, because of just how they incorporated the use of the music, and of course having the Walkman thing and kind of the throwback to that, but. What's funny about the whole concept of the Walkman and him flying is there was, especially here in the United States, so many teenagers, that's how they would play video games. You'd have your Walkman in your ears and you're playing video games and you were syncing up your music to the video game. And there's a great book by Ernest Cline, the author of Ready Player One, called Armada, that deals with this and mentions the Iron Eagle and listening to the Walkman and kind of having these different soundtracks to what you're the games they're playing, and it's quite interesting. But that the Walkman in the ears while you were playing video games and stuff like that was very much an 80s teen trope, and it was interesting here that where they move it here to where he's actually doing it while he's flying. So, but I think a lot of teenagers and people from that era can identify with that.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, who wanted to listen to 8-bit music like back in the day on the NES? No.
Also, another great song on the soundtrack, and it actually wasn't on the official soundtrack, but Old Enough to Rock and Roll by Rainey Haynes, which actually has never really had an official album release. She sold it as a single. It's a great song. It's a song they play that Doug is playing on his Walkman as he's doing the race scene with Notcher.
That's right. And also, there's instrumental work by Basil Poledouris.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a decent score. What's amazing to me, again, I go back to this movie had a lot of potential to it, and it was just annihilated by Top Gun. It's across the board, Top Gun was such a phenomenon. Nothing stood a chance.
You couldn't compete to it. You know, it'd be like Stargate trying to compete to Star Trek if they had a release out
of the time. I said, there's a feel of this movie when you watch it as far as the effects and the fight scenes and the fighting scenes. I compare it to Red Dawn feels like a good comparison to me as far as just how it has that kind of little bit of a low-budget feel for it. The Delta Force is another movie that kind of has a similar type feel because you're on a rescue mission and just how they filmed it. This movie is kind of like, I would call it a slightly above average canon film with how it felt like with the budget and everything like that at the time.
You know what it is? It's missing in action with F-16s.
Basically, yeah, and a bunch of teenagers. Now, like I said, though, it just works. And it's one of those movies I don't think you can truly explain why it works. It just works and you enjoy it. And I think that's kind of a lost art we have now in modern film and television is we don't have those shows that just come out and they just work and you can't really explain it, but you just roll with it.
Oh, totally. Let's have a look at some of the critical responses. So Kevin Thomas of the Los Angeles Times said it was ludicrous, preposterous, a total waste of time, but
achieves a kind of perfection of awfulness that only earnest effort can produce.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I want to ask you, Adam, because being from Australia, there's a lot of things in this that are very much, if you're from the United States, you're going to identify with it. You're going to understand what's going on. But you being in Australia, there's probably a lot of it you took as a different perspective than what we took with this film in the US.
Well, first one, why would you want to race through canyons like that and stuff like that, even in a bike, when you can do it by the beach? Or in through shrub and stuff like that and proper terrain. It's one thing that's different. Our terrains are different. So that always sort of put us left of field. I think it's those parts of wherever this was shot. There's parts of California that are like that. And so close to the coast, you know, it's very different from our sort of areas. But I think the big thing is the way that the Air Force just let people in. That wouldn't happen here. No. You know, basically, you go to any of the big, we've got a big base here called Amberley Air Force Base, huge Air Force Base, just in the north of Brisbane. And it's almost the size of a city, like it's massive. You can't get within a hair's breadth of the place without, you know, what we call the Air Force Guards, which are called Aggies, fully armed, coming out and basically putting you down in handcuffs and taking you away until you're way out of the area. So how these kids just trotted on in and then played with the F-16 flight simulators? Yeah, nah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the stretch of the film. I mean, even here, there's no way that ever happens. It's just, it's absolutely impossible. It's a fun Hollywood thing, and it is so much a Hollywood thing, but it's part of the fun that makes this movie enjoyable. But there's just no way, one, that Doug Masters is even getting in with his dad flying in the back seat of those planes. And two, just there's no way they have the access to the information they have.
And it's interesting that they were able to get a two-seater F-16B. Yeah. Just I mean, wouldn't they be training planes, those ones? You couldn't arm them.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, this is not the most, this is not like Top Gun where it's the most military accurate of films. But I think when they made this film, they weren't worried too much about military accuracy as they were just making a fun film.
Oh, look, this is definitely aimed at the juvenile, teenage to adult market. I mean, it's not aimed at, you know, being accurate to that sort of thing. You know, this is that Airwolf sort of market, pretty much. There you go.
Well, I mean, and the thing about it is that I think you kind of hit on it on the Airwolf thing and trying to capitalize on a little bit of that as well. But again, I just look at this falls into those great 80s films, and you don't need an explanation, you just enjoy it. But I am curious, Adam, what do you think, what is the reason why Iron Eagle still kind of has a place in people's hearts today? What do you think the reason is for that?
I think, you know, and this is one of the reasons I actually do think it's as good as Top Gun personally. Is because it's a coming-of-age story, you know, and that's why, you know, back in the VHS days, we were doing the same. So for us, it is, you know, something that harkens back to the time when we were growing up, but it's also a story of, you know, Doug Masters going through the same stuff, except he's got to do it within a film and become a pilot by the end of it. So in some ways, it's right up there with Luke's journey in Star Wars, with obviously Mavericks, not so much because Maverick is already a pilot and all that, but definitely with Daniel LaRusso. I actually think this has got more akin to Karate Kid than any other movie, because it's the Karate Kid with F-16s, pretty much. Like, that's, you know, he's got his own Mr. Miyagi with, of course, Chappie. Chappie's the wizened master who's, you know, had his day, but still has a bit of fight in him and has got a lot of tricks up his sleeve. Same with Mr. Miyagi. They're magicians. They're wizards. They're, you know, they are the Gandalfs of these films. And that's what makes this one good, because it does have those hurdles that he's got to go through. He's got to go through the hurdle of first being a man by himself, bring up his brother, being there with his family. We don't get much of a love story with his girlfriend. I think there's one thing that they could have explored a bit more in the film, but it's a bit of fluff, really, for the story, the way it's put out.
I think I'm glad they didn't go around down that road, just because I think it would have added too many elements. I think the fact that they kept it pretty tight on the rescue mission and the mission itself is one of the reasons why this movie works. I think if they would have focused too much on the love story with his girlfriend or things like that, even with the aspect of his mom and that aspect. They kept it low key. And they put the focus where it needs to be. And I think that's one of the reasons why this movie works, is it's kind of got a laser focus on what it's trying to do.
Oh, without a doubt. But I think the action does hold up. Like, for me, the way it was laid out with that, yes, it works. Does it work as well in the sequels? Probably not. But I think this one, and the rock and roll, it was always the rock soundtrack that brought me back to more viewings later. So it would be, you know, in the late 80s or mid 90s, I'd always have a chance to rewatch this while it was on VHS, but had not seen it on DVD until about a week ago.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. I think the music is an absolute huge part of this as well. It's just, it keeps itself tight. And you talked about that with the sequels, especially Iron Eagle 2, which just felt a little scattered. I mean, you killed Doug Masters in the first 10 minutes of that film, and it felt a little scattered. Aces works, which is the third film, just because of the fact you have all these old World War II aces, and they used the old classic planes. And Iron Eagle 4 is just something that should have never happened for you. Those of you who don't, and maybe you've never seen it, they do bring back the Doug Masters character. It turns out the whole time he actually had ejected, which makes no sense when you watch how Iron Eagle 2 plays out, and that he was a prisoner in a Russian camp, and he's all upset at Chappie because Chappie never came to save him.
That's right. He's basically stuck where he was, you know, the storyline. I still have not seen this one, so it kind of feels like I need to see it.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember correctly, stuff with planes was actually very, very limited in Iron Eagle 4 even, so.
Ah, a bit more of a, Delta Force style, yeah?
Yeah, if even that. It was more of like, you know, by this point, it was Chappie with some inner city youth and things like that, if I remember correctly. It has been a good while since I've seen this film.
That's right. So, folks, have a little bit of a dive in now into the sequels. But first, before we do that, what is your rating on the Hallenbach scale, but out of 5 for this one?
You know what? For me, this is kind of, some would call it a guilty pleasure enjoyment. I love this movie. I'll revisit it at least once a year. If nothing else, just for the memories it brings back and stuff. It's going to get a 4 out of 5 for me, just on the nostalgia factor alone.
I'm going to give it that too. Actually, it's 4. Look, it could be a lot better than it is, but it's a 4 is a good score for it. Iron Eagle 2, which was called The Battle Beyond the Flag, came out in 1988, directed by the same director, Sidney J. Fury, and written by him and Kevin Allen Elders again. This is the first sequel to the 86 film. Lewis Gossett came back as Chappie alongside some pretty interesting actors in this one. Mark Humphrey, Stuart Mogulyn, Maury Chaykin, Alan Scar, folks. Now, if you're an action movie fan, you should know who that is. Should be nodding your head. Should be going, Double Impact. That's right, the bad guy. The British bad guy. Oh, look, it's Frank Avery. You should know that one very well. Because he's the one bringing the cognac into Harpalin Bay, and has to put up with Chad and Alex Baya. Anyway, that's another film, folks. But this is great because we get to see him. He's also in Babylon 5, by the way. I forgot to tell you. So Alan Scar, go and check him out. Colm Feore, the Lord Marshal of the Underverse, is in this as well. Does that guy ever age? He looks exactly the same.
No, he doesn't age. It's disgusting.
Now, this film is, I think, the Police Academy of the Iron Eagle series. It is funnier than it should be. It shouldn't be funny, but it is. And it doesn't make a lot of sense, put it that way.
This movie makes no sense. Doug Masters gets killed. All of a sudden, Chappie's recruited into this mission. It makes no sense that he's even recruited into this mission. The mission itself barely makes sense as it is. The training that they're going through just doesn't, there's nothing about this movie that makes sense. The truth of the matter is, outside of Chappie, you could care less about any of the characters. And, you know, I think most people were just so completely turned off by the fact that they killed Doug Masters within the first 10 minutes of this film that it's one of those things where you're trying to do something shocking, but it just totally takes everybody out of the film. And I think it was a huge mistake, and a huge mistake in the direction they went in, and this film is just This film should have never happened in the first place. I actually remember seeing this in the theater because both myself and my dad were fans of the original Iron Eagle, so we wanted to go see it, but it was just such a disappointment. It wasn't that great of a film, and yeah, it's not. I can't even tell you the last time I saw Iron Eagle 2. I've seen it. It was on cable TV. I can tell you that, but it does. It got play for a while. I would say maybe in the early 90s on cable a lot, but then it's kind of disappeared, and I haven't seen it on cable in a very long time, which tells you something there. I don't even know if you can find it on something like Tubi or something like that. It's kind of tough. Aces actually ended up getting a lot more play on cable TV than even Iron Eagle 2 did.
Now, it had a Bond director, John Glenn. John Glenn, you'll know very well, not the astronaut, but the director, the British director, who did editing on Honor Her Majesty's Secret Service, The Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker. But he also directed For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, The Living Daylights, and License to Kill. Some of the toughest of the Bond films, folks, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was the first and only in the series that wasn't directed by Sidney J. Fury. Louis Gossett Jr. came back, played Chappie. The only other ones that really have known, and this are brand new to the series. In this, we've got Paul Freeman from, of course, Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's Balak! And we also have Sonny Chiba, the late Sonny Chiba. It's very sad this week to hear the passing of the legend Sonny Chiba from Street Fighter fame and many other amazing films. So our thoughts go out to his family and to his fans out there who are mourning his loss, and may he rest in peace. But also Horst Buchholz, who was famous for, of course, The Magnificent Seven. And, you know, he's a very, what can we say, James Dean-like character in that one. You know, he's the young gunfighter-to-be sort of character. Christopher Cazenovi, and we've got Mitchell Ryan and J.E. Freeman as well. Now, this film I found was quite interesting. It was one that was a little bit more of a Delta Force-style film, this one. But you also had the added bit where you got all these old retired flyers going out there, and they're kind of helping everybody in the way of the film. And Sonny's great in that. But also you got Horst Buchholz in this. It's fantastic as well. It's all the old villains, all the old ex-enemies from World War II getting back together to help them sort out what's going on.
Yeah, no. Again, this film was fun for that. It was a direct-to-DVD release in America, but you know, it was definitely a B movie at this point, and this franchise mm-hmm. had been turned into a B situation. And you know, one way you can always tell if you have a good B movie is, especially during this time frame, there was just certain actors, if they showed up in your film, you knew you were probably headed to B movie land. And in this case, it's Rob Estes who is in this film. He plays Doyle, but Rob Estes was probably most well known as one of the leads in the show Silk Stockings, which is a syndicated show on the USA Network about a couple of private detectives in Miami Beach. He also had a run for several years on Melrose Place as well. But mm-hmm. Rob Estes is very much known as kind of that B-movie actor, kind of had that hunky look to him. And when you saw him on your screen, you knew you were either watching late-night television or you were watching a B-movie.
But you've also got J.E. Freeman in this from Patriot Games and Alien Resurrection and mm-hmm. Highlander, folks. Yes, I can hear Kevin and Lee listening right now. Yes, he was in the first season. But J.E. Freeman, of course, plays Marty Cantor in Patriot Games, the foil to Harrison Ford's Jack Ryan. It's pretty funny. So we've got also in this Rachel McLish, who is a... I think she's a female bodybuilding champion back in the early 80s. She's also an actress and author as well. But she makes quite an impression in this, kicking people all over the shop in this one. She's done quite a bit of martial arts for this one too. So the film fell pretty flat with a gross of $2.5 million on a budget of about $13 or $14 million. So not exactly a rip-roaring success.
Yeah. Well, and then that leads us into Iron Eagle 4, or otherwise known as Iron Eagle on the Attack. Mm-hmm. And this is why it goes wrong, because they do bring Doug Masters back, but Jason Gedrick is not reprising the role of Doug Masters. And I had forgotten about this, but Jason Cadu reprising the role of Doug Masters.
That's a bit weird.
Here's the plot synopsis. When Chappie St. Clair is saddled with a bunch of misfits and delinquents for his flight school, he turns to his protege, Doug Masters, to assist him in sharpening them for an important competition. During their training, they stumble upon a group of subversive U.S. Air Force officers who are dealing in toxic waste as a sideline. It's weird. The whole Doug Masters thing was just kind of strange, and a lot of people were kind of like thrown. But by this point, the Iron Eagle franchise had gotten so low. I mean, this was another direct-to-DVD release that barely did registered on that, and a lot of people didn't even see it until it hit cable.
Okay, we got 95. Yeah, so they were really banging the war drum by this time of like getting this thing out, everything out of it they could. I think, yes, leave it just as the first film. Is this like the Highlander sequels? Yes, it is.
I think it's worse than the Highlander sequels, except for The Source, because nothing is worse than The Source.
I know, Battlefield Earth's pretty bad.
Battlefield Earth makes The Source... let me put it this way. The Source makes Battlefield Earth look like a Oscar-winning film.
It certainly does. Well, folks, we've chatted about Iron Eagle, something that I think you need to revisit. I will be, depending on how we go through some of these ones, I do want to look at some of the other sequels in their own episodes down the line, because they're comedy, folks. They're not great films, but they are worth laughing at. So why not? We'll do it.
I think you need to do a whole show just on a lot of these 80s films that came out that were just unintentional comedy.
Yeah, well, this is it. You know, there's a lot of Hulk Hogan films, folks, which we're going to be looking at, which are wannabe Schwarzenegger films, which are just unintentionally hilarious. You can even see Hulk trying to hide back the laughs when he's doing Bad Lives.
All I know is Noel Holds Barred did star the greatest president in the history of film.
Looks like we're going to have to look at No Holds Barred, folks. Just by this.
Tiny Lester is the greatest president in the history of modern cinema. Let's be honest.
Fifth Element, man. You know, of course he is. He's fantastic.
Exactly.
Yeah, he just should have been playing the president more. He's great. So what more can we look forward to seeing you on soon on the Fandom Podcast Network?
We got, of course, our Fandom News and Review show, Culture Clash, our latest episode. It hits our newest feature, which we call the timeline, where we take a look at a actor or director or actress's career, or even maybe somewhere down the line, a producer or a composer. And we just look at what they've done throughout their career, kind of figure out what maybe was their breakout moment, what was their apex film, or and if they had that point where they just should have stopped, or if they even in after that, if they had a comeback. But in our most recent episode, we did the guy who many people consider the greatest action star going today, and that is The Rock.
Oh, nice. The man that can't get his own franchise.
Well, I think that's coming, though. And I think there's been an intentional... We have that discussion, and I think there's some intentional reasons why The Rock hasn't committed to any one franchise outside of probably Luke Hobbs. But check out that episode. We did that. And of course, too, we have our newest show, which is True Believers, which we're covering everything happening in the MCU. And of course, right now, that means covering What If on Disney Plus, which has been very fun for an animated show. And the second episode dealing with what if T'Challa had become Star-Lord. It was also one of Chadwick Boseman's last performances ever. And so it pulls out the heartstrings, but what a phenomenal episode. And we're covering everything going on with What If, and including our most recent episode, which will be out next, by the time we're recording this, will be out probably within about a week. We talk about the latest episode of What If the Avengers had never formed, and also talk about the release of the new Spider-Man Far From Home, No Way Home trailer, which has had the internet abuzz right now.
There's a few little guest roles in that one, folks. If you haven't seen them already, you need to check them out. But we're just waiting for, let's just say, Toby and, of course, a certain other guy to turn up.
Come on. We all know these villains are showing up because now they can kidnap hot Aunt May.
Yes. So, you know, it's interesting. And now that Sony is now calling their Spider-Verse the Sony Spider-Verse.
Yeah, it's going to be, I have some interesting thoughts about what's going to happen with Spider-Man after this film. And needless to say, Disney, I think Disney is going to end up with Disney adding another movie studio to their collection.
I think so. I think they'll end up buying that out very, very shortly. It's, you know, if
they, I think they just might buy all of Sony Pictures, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yep. Well, you know, and what do you do? Once you've got Disney running everything, who knows, folks? Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? They might even make a play for Warner Brothers one day.
Hey, you never know. And Warner just got sold, so I think it's safe for a while.
Oh, I think so. I think so. Well, folks, I hope you've enjoyed today's episode looking at Iron Eagle. Much more on your way here at Lethal Metal Network. I want to thank Kyle for coming in and enjoying the fun today, chatting a bit of F-16 fun. And, of course, you can find him at where?
You can find me on Twitter at AKyleW or on Instagram at AKyleFandom. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network at fpnet.podbean.com or also on YouTube. And, of course, if you're looking for my co-founder, Kevin Reisel, you can find him on social media, on Twitter and Instagram, at Spartan_Phoenix. And, of course, all over the place on the Fandom Podcast Network, including his love. And he did something very cool. I just got a shout-out to him. He was just one of the host panelists for WatcherCon, which is the virtual Highlander convention that just happened, where our good friend John Mosby was a big part of getting that off the ground. Kevin hosted several panels for that, and he's going to be doing some follow-up on that on Blood of Kings, it was a phenomenal job by both him and the co-host of that show, Lee Fillingsness, representing Blood of Kings well and representing Highlander amazingly so.
But I can't believe they didn't mention Jaguar Lives. My God!
I think we're safe.
You know, folks, if you get a chat to Anthony DeLonghi's, you've got to bring up the classic films he was part of. It's just a must. Oh. You have to do it.
Oh, wait. If you want to talk Anthony DeLonghi's, I bet I can throw out a movie of Anthony DeLonghi's you might not even know about.
Oh, here we go.
Are you familiar with the movie Star Chaser?
Ah, I've heard.
The Star Chaser, The Legend of Orin, an animated film where Anthony DeLonghi's is the voice of the main villain. This came out in the early 80s. Definitely has a little bit of a Star Wars kind of feel, maybe even a little bit of a heavy metal kind of feel as well. But if it is streaming, at least here in the U.S. on Amazon Prime, check it out if you're an Anthony DeLonghi's fan. It's an interesting experience, and we'll just leave it at that.
I will say this, folks, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be doing Circle of Iron here, which is an actual Anthony DeLonghi's film as well. Came out a couple of years after Jaguar Lives. And it is all about the silent flute. The story by, of course, Bruce Lee, which was kind of a bit more adapted, and to David Carradine. And it's an interesting movie in its own. It's a fantasy kung fu film, and we'll be chatting about that here on this very show. All right, folks, we'll love you and leave you. Live from here, Quinlan's Canteen and the Gold Coast of Australia. We'll catch you next time. See you later.
G'day, folks. Hope you're enjoying the great shows here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Be sure to check out all the great shows that we have on offer and subscribe on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. You can check Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Rysel and Lee Fillingsness on their platform. You can also check out Culture Clash, which is the weekly look at pop culture hosted by Kevin and Kyle. Couch Potato Theatre, this is a cult classics and guilty pleasure podcast. Also Time Warp, a fandom flashback show. End Zone, a look at the NFL, the American football. Also Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, looking at the great films of Alfred Hitchcock. Union Federation podcast, a Star Trek and Orville podcast, looking at Discovery, and of course Picard, plus the Orville. Also the Hair Metal podcast, looking at the great shows put on by the amazing bands back in the late 80s, their discs, their LPs, everything, all covering the fashion as well, hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. You can also check out Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, hosted by Kevin and Dan Hadley, looking at all the eras of Doctor Who. You can also catch out What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, an amazing show looking at Star Wars, hosted by Derek and Scott. And of course, our newest one, the amazing, The Mullet Guild, an offshoot of the Lethal Mullet podcast looking at Frank Herbert's Dune universe. This is like an encyclopedia for Dune, where I take you through and down into the rabbit hole of Frank Herbert's amazing space opera, the sprawling universe which is going to be brought to life by Denis Villeneuve and December 18. You can check out all the shows there. Be sure to also go onto the social platforms on Twitter at FanPod Network. Let us know what you think of the shows and what else you can look at there. You can also check out great articles that we put up through there that we share. Also check out on Instagram and Facebook, Fandom Podcast Network. Be sure to make sure that every Tuesday you check out the great work done by Making Treks as well. A brand new podcast looking at a deep dive of Star Trek, hosted by myself, James Semple, and of course, the ever popular and amazing writer of Star Trek and Star Wars, Mark Newbold. Go and check it out, folks, and we'll catch you next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet Podcast. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.